Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The Andy J Podcast.
Hey, welcome to the very latest episode of the Andy J Podcast. I hope you're having a really strong and happy week. Now, we have just one guest for you this week. It's a deep dive kind of chat. And let me just check how long the chat is with... it's like over an hour and 20 minutes with Mel Gedridge. I'm so excited for this. This is Mel from Mel and Sue, if you aren't familiar with the surname. She's brilliant. What a ray of sunshine Mel was. Now, I just want to put a little apology out at the start. This is a terrible thing to be doing, but I've been getting some heat on Twitter and now I'm reacting to it because I've had a lot of people accuse me of being too nice and all this kind of nonsense, which... fancy accusing someone of being too nice. Anyway, they've done it. I've listened back to... This is an interview that was embargoed for quite a long time. Mel and I did it a few weeks ago because she's written this book and it's a lovely book and it's out now. And... I'd been sent an early copy and was told I could have a whole hour of Mel, provided I recorded it many moons ago, a few weeks ago now. And in between that time, I've had people giving me heat for being nice. So I've listened back to this interview, which was a few weeks ago now, and I realised that I'm a bit gushy about her book. Now, I must be straightforward with you. I really enjoyed the book. I read it in one sitting and did really enjoy it. But I kind of do labour that point a little bit with Mel. So sorry for those of you that think I'm being too nice. There you go. It's just how it is. I'm giving you that warning in advance. There will be some gushiness that's perhaps a little excessive about her book, but I did enjoy it. So there we go. What I really enjoyed, however, was Mel's company, and she brings her A game. You'll hear at the start, you know, we have this fun little chat beforehand where I tell her that, you know, she needs to be on alert because I might have to dash off and have a baby, and she's just hilarious even then. She had me in stitches throughout this chat. I'm sure it will be the same for you. It's also fascinating. Her life story is really, really cool. And she doesn't hold anything back. You know, she just allows you to just chat and ask the questions and she goes for it. There's a lot of people that sometimes sidestep things or get a bit defensive or don't quite answer where you're going. Whereas she was just like, you know what? I'm in this conversation. I'm going to give you my honesty. And I loved her for it. She was great. Such a bundle of joy. I hope and think this is going to put a huge smile on your face. Again, pre-warning about the gushiness about the book, but nonetheless, it's good. So there. Hey, thanks for choosing the AJ Pod. I really, really appreciate it. Have a fun listen and have a great week.
The Andy J Podcast.
I am so thrilled to welcome my very special guest for the whole show. No pressure, Mel. This is going to be a big one. She's a presenter, a comedian, an actor, an author. She's one of our best-loved entertainers. She's a national treasure. I mean, I'm ranking up the pressure here, Mel. It is the wonderful... Mel Gedridge, how are you doing, Mel?
Oh, Andy, it's so nice to be on the show. I'm a little bit concerned that I'm on for the whole hour. I hope I've got enough material to stretch... that far. It might get a bit thin. Let's see how we go.
The good news is, Mel, you're not new to this. You know, you're not sort of, well, I've got one thing to talk about. You've had a rather sensational career, so I think we'll be okay.
Oh, that's very lovely of you to say so, but I sort of feel it's slightly jack of all trades, mistress of none, but enough of the self-deprecation. Let's carry on. Come on.
I love it. Well, look, first and foremost, you've got a new book out. I want to talk all about it. I read it. I want to tell you this and then we'll come back to it if that's all right. But I have to. Yes. I do feel the need to share this with you at the start.
Please do.
I was fortunate enough to have been sent an advance copy, which is great.
Chat,
which is lovely. I read it in one go.
Oh, dear. Oh, did you?
Yeah.
It's over 400 pages, Andy. How long were you sitting down there for? I hope you whizzed through.
It was about 6 hours.
Oh, wow. Blimey, I don't think I've ever done that with a book, actually, to be honest.
It is staggeringly rare. Firstly, I never get a chance to read. You know what this like as a parent. You never get a chance to read. But I was able to kind of say, look, it's for work. You know, I'll just find a little corner of the house, stick the fire on and, you know, off we go. And I genuinely didn't think I'd do it in one hit. Genuinely thought, okay, well, I'll just make a start, and then I'll, you know, I've got a few days, so I'll just make a start now. I'll maybe do 40 pages now. I did it all in one. Mel, brilliant!
That's very lovely. I love the image of you sitting in a little corner with the fire on. That's so nice.
Oh, thanks.
Did you have to sort of barrage the door so that the kids wouldn't come in?
I'm not going to lie. There were a couple of moments when I was thinking maybe I'll need to sit in the car now, you know. But
I've done that before. I've done that before. To get away from the family, I've sat in the car. I think we all have, haven't we?
Oh, yes. Especially with the old pandemic and everything else. Because, look, I mean, we're all basically in the same space all the time and have been forever, right? So
I need to find
other little spaces. I mean, I've found cupboards quite helpful from time to time.
I call it my nook, which is, it's a sort of wardrobe come office, come recording studio, come bolt hole. I've been in the nook. So hang on, what are we? April, so the last year. I'd say 60% of the time I've been in the nook.
Wow. That's impressive. and actually, Mel, that should be a tattoo. 60% of the time I've been in a nook. You know, that would work across the floor.
Yes, on my lower back. I don't know if this is a thing, a sort of post or in the middle of lockdown thing. I reckon a lot of people are going to be getting tattoos done. Don't you reckon?
Yes, I do.
I actually want to get one done. Have you got any already?
Do you know what, right? I have nearly had one twice, and I am currently on the waiting list for someone I consider to be the greatest tattoo artist in the UK.
Well, now, hang on. It's not LOL, is it? Is it somebody called LOL?
His actual name is Mowgli.
Fantastic.
That's his tattoo name. And I've been on his waiting list. It's bizarre, right? I can't believe we're talking tattoos, Mel. I love it.
It's great.
You have to apply to be inked by him. Right. And you have to give him a series of themes and ideas that appeal and inspire you to see if he gets appealed and inspired by as well. And then you get contacted by his people to say yay or nay. So
that's
it was
marvelous.
A great honour when I got this message going, yeah, Mowgli will be able to tattoo you. Well, then.
So
in three years' time.
That's amazing. Mm. Wow. So if he's not into your kind of concept for the tattoo, that's it. You don't get the call.
And you're not allowed to submit like drawings or, you know, I want this face or anything. You have to, it's themes and ideas and, you know, things that inspire.
Is it going to be one of those sort of Celtic-y type things?
No.
Is it going to be one of those Japanese type things? What's the aesthetic?
He's a fine ink artist, and I'm in my 40s, so with the old skin turning, I can't risk anything that's going to look awful straight away, you know, because you know what it's like. The skin isn't what it used
God.
To be.
So, hey, I mean, I'm in my 50s. I've got to think very, 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 very carefully, A, about the design, and B, about where it goes, because everything's shifting. Everything's on the shift.
What are you currently thinking? Whereabouts are we locating it at the moment, Mel?
So I'm thinking, I don't know what you think about this, I'm thinking a seahorse.
Okay.
Because I just love them. I absolutely love them. I want it to be quite small. It's probably not going to be longer than an inch or so.
Right.
Now, how do we feel about the wrist?
Well, the wrist is going to hurt. Wrist is a good shout, but it's a very painful part of the body.
Okay, fair dues. It's the underside of the wrist as well. Yeah. Okay, fair dues. So maybe somewhere a little bit more, let's say, insulated.
I would say lower chin.
Which one? There are about three currently. So
jawline. Go jawline. Go all in.
Jawline. Lordy. It's got to be somewhere. I tell you what, it's also got to be somewhere where my girls will never see. Because if I get a tattoo before them, A, they'll be really cross. B, they'll be very, very embarrassed. And C, they will immediately go out and get one that is bigger, bolder. So do you know what I'm saying?
Yes, I do.
They can never, ever see this. So it's got to be somewhere where your children would never see, which is quite weird,
that's
actually, because
yeah.
They see pretty much everything, don't they?
Yes.
I don't know.
You could go armpit.
Armpit. Where are you having yours done?
I'm going to be very basic and standard. I'm just going to go upper bicep. Left arm, I think. Yeah.
Maybe, left arm. That's, yeah. Have you got some definition there? Is how's lockdown been treating?
Do you know, I had some pre-lockdown definition, and now I've got Toblerone and chocolate orange.
Oh, God, it's really hard not to eat in these strange times.
Well, I mean, I've just been loving eating, Mel. I mean,
I know.
Do you know what? There it is. Can't swim. Can't do anything else. Fine. No problem. I'll accept that.
Oh, I miss the swimming. I really miss the swimming. A lot of my friends, again, in our 50s, have really got into the cold water swimming concept, I've got to say, it's addictive. It is absolutely addictive. I've done it a couple of times. I've never done it long enough for it to become an addiction, but I've got mates down in Southend. They are in the sea the whole time. I've got a very good friend in Oxford, and she's in the river every day. It's a thing. It's a big thing.
This Wim Hof fella, he's got a lot to answer for, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm going to make the assumption, Mel, that most of these cold water swimming friends are ladies.
Actually, one is a gent.
Right.
One's a gent, and he's a very, very good egg. He's one of the top dressers. In fact, he's probably the top dresser in the West End.
Wow.
So he is the, your kind of, he does everything costume wise, and is your sort of confidant, He's a sort of dresser to the divas, basically. He's amazing. Really lovely guy, Murray. And quite unexpectedly, he's an old friend of mine. We worked together on the musical Time with Cliff Richard back in the 80s. Dave Clark's Time, mate.
No way.
Yes, we did.
With the stage that went up and around and all kinds
yes!
of... Yes!
And the Laurence Olivier as a hologram, which was one of the most terrifying things I think the West End has ever witnessed.
Yes!
I was 18. I was a lonely stagehand. I mean, I literally was the lowest of the low. I was below stage, making sure that the curtains didn't get stuck in the hydraulic equipment. So that was my job. I never saw daylight. And I think Murray then, now he literally is top dresser in the West End. I think he was just washing thongs and dancers' regalia in the laundry area.
There's a role. Thong washing for Dave Clark's Time. I mean, well done.
Yeah. And there were a lot of thongs on that show. It was wall-to-wall song. So, yeah, Murray got in touch. He's such a good man. And, yeah, he's literally in the sea at Southend, near Southend, every day. He looks 10 years younger. I'm not going to lie. I said, Murray, this has done wonders. I mean, he always looks great, Murray, but, it's unbelievable. People are swearing by it.
I mean, listen, I'm impressed by people like that, Mel, but I'm also highly envious of them. Where they find the time, I'm assuming, again, big assumption here, a lot of my time has been taken up during lockdown with children being home.
Yeah.
And work. It's not that easy to just kind of take yourself off
for
a water swim or whatever.
I know. I totally know. No, absolutely. We've had, so my elder daughter is in the middle of an arts foundation, so all her stuff went online for a while, of course, so she took over the garden shed. Oh my God, hilarious.
Brilliant.
You couldn't see into the shed because of the fog of smoke. There was just a lot of smoking going on in there.
Wow. Is she a smoker or a vapor?
She's a smoker. I'm trying to wean her off, but I was a very heavy smoker at the age of 18, so I sort of feel, I haven't got much of a leg to stand on, but I'm trying. She's on the rollies. She's wearing a beret. She's listening to Hendrix.
Wow.
It's all go
on
the old.
She's living it.
Yes. And the younger daughter's been doing low sixth at home, on and off, and... Yes, she's doing drama A-level, and there were some quite interesting noises coming out of her bedroom. There was a lot of sort of warming up and then some primal screaming, various getting into characters. It has been it's been quite lively at our end.
Sounds like there's been moments where you've been approaching the shut door with a nice cup of tea for her and then just, I'll just turn around. I'll do a 180.
Absolutely. And lots of sort of, yeah, as you say, lots of kind of getting into cupboards. And have you seen the wondrous series that is Schitt's Creek, which was on... Of course.
Bebe, I fell in love with it. I loved it.
Isn't it amazing? Isn't it amazing?
To the point, Mel, and I'm going to... There's a bit of a confession for me. I actually cried on the last episode. Because it was over.
Yeah.
Not because of the conclusion or what happened. Just because I wouldn't be having these people in my life every day again.
I know. I'm totally with you. And when it finished, I don't know if you did this, but I immediately went to, you know, all the possible interviews with them,
yeah,
you know, their appearances on chat shows. There's a documentary actually or two about them.
Yes.
But I love the fact that it's such a sort of family affair. You know, the Levy family, Eugene Levy, what a legend.
Yeah.
Dan, his son, amazing. Brilliant. And then Eugene's brother is the executive producer on the show, I think. And then their daughter who plays...
I'm thinking of the other one.
The waitress.
Waitress.
Oh,
yes.
What's her name?
Oh, it'll come back to you in a second.
It'll come back.
Twyla,
thank you. I've always absolutely loved that sort of... Catherine O'Hara, I've always been totally obsessed with, because she did so much work with Christopher Guest, and she's in Mighty Wind, she's in Best in Show... She's an absolute legend.
And she's so good in this. She's so brave in it as well, isn't she? She just throws herself in. Yeah.
She's amazing. But I love the way that she gets into the cupboard, you know, when things are really, really rock bottom, which of course they often are on that show.
Frequently, yeah.
She's in the closet with all her boots and stuff. It's just very, very strong.
Mel,
she is amazing.
She's brilliant. And Mel, I must be honest, right? We've been chatting for just a few minutes now, and I feel like you and I could have done lockdown quite well together, actually.
Oh, that would have been so nice.
You know, just, I think we could have had a lot of fun. We could have designed it. I want to make a few amendments to your seahorse. I feel like it needs a little bit of robo in the tail, and maybe a human face of someone famous.
What sort of Ian Botham or something?
or Gandalf. You know, let's stick with the Ian and just chuck a McKellen in there.
Actually, I'd rather have McKellen than Botham, I'm not going to lie.
Yeah, why was Botham your go-to, out of curiosity?
I don't know. I think it's because, I tell you exactly for why. My husband, Ben, is a cricket obsessive. I mean, an absolute cricket obsessive. So there's always a lot of chat about the cricket, and there's usually some cricket on somewhere. And before speaking to you, we had just had a chat about two cricketers, Marcus Truscothick and Ian Botham.
Well,
so that's why Ian Botham suddenly came into my head. But I'm not going to have a tattoo of Ian Botham. I'm absolutely 100% not going to have a tattoo of Ian Botham. Ian Dury. Yes.
Ian Dury. Yeah, that could work. Oh. On a seahorse's body with a robo tail. I'm there. That could work.
That's quite... Are you having any human figures in your tattoo?
Well, that's kind of up to Mowgli, to be honest.
That's up to Mowgli. Does he do human figures, or is he more into sort of...
Oh, yeah, he does.
Does he?
He's very, very good. You'll have to look him up. I'll send you a couple of images after this.
He's obviously a real sort of inking legend by the sounds of him.
Yeah, he's like the king ink, as it were.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Because I was, I don't know even if he's still inking, but there was an amazing guy in the 80s called Lal. It could be Lal, actually.
Okay.
I can't remember if it's Lal or Lol. And he was in the Muswell Hill area of London. And I had a few mates that went to him in the 80s. And so I sort of thought it'd be quite fun to kind of go to him if he's still around and doing it.
Yeah.
But,
you want to make sure that he's still got an eye, you know, that his eyes are still good and he's got a good steady hand. Otherwise, you know, that might be a regretful decision.
Yeah, and also the colours are really important as well. The colours, particularly on a 50-something skin. You don't want to be going for that green that just goes really bleedy and fadey. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. You've got it. I'm with you. But I think we're doing this at the right time, Mel, because, you know, we're already coming at it with slightly older skin, which makes me think the tattoo will last and be more vibrant for longer.
Oh, that's good. Yes, I like that.
That's where I'm going.
Yeah, that's very good. I'm going to go with that, definitely. I'm going to go with that. We'll see.
Do you know what? This is a very interesting kind of slice of pop culture into your life, Mel. I certainly didn't have you pegged as a tattoo person. I'm expecting you to tell me that you love, you know, graffiti art and graphic novels next. I'm delighted by this.
Oh, do you know what? I've got a nephew, Fred, who is launching into, I think, a really, really fantastically promising career as a graphic artist, I suppose.
Yeah.
He is amazing. He sort of started at the age of about 13, probably. He's now in his early 20s, and it's literally all he does. And of course, you know, he's all over Instagram and various other platforms, shall we say, and doing really, really well. It's just so exciting. It's not something, I mean, via him, I'm obviously going to, you know, get involved. It's not, graphic novels are not something I've ever really been heavily into. It all is a bit Gotham for me, do you know what I'm saying? It's a bit, it's all, I mean, I don't even know where to start. I know nothing about them. Are you into those kind of things?
Yeah, big time. Oh yes, I'm a graphic novel nerd. I mean, Mel, I've just got to join the dots for you here. You've got a nephew who's a kind of aspiring graphic novel.
Yeah, legend.
You've got a desire to have a tattoo. Why not use the two? He should be designing it for you, surely.
Actually, that's a really good idea. But if I said to him, "Look, Fred, do a seahorse," I mean, I'd literally come out with some. I mean, it could be amazing, but it would be something so unlike a seahorse.
You're keeping it in the family, Mel. You know, you've just admired Schitt's Creek for doing exactly that for the Levies. I think you should do the same.
Oh, okay. Actually, that's a very, very strong idea. I might have to give Fred a call. I try and get him something graphic-y for Christmas, and I end up going into these amazing graphic novel-type shops, which are astounding.
Yeah.
They are amazing. And the people working behind the counter, equally astonishing and amazing.
Caves of joy.
Caves of joy. Yeah, and I can see if you got into it, it would literally take over your life. I think I got him.
And you should, because life is here to be taken over right now. So there's a whole new world out there. You could fall for it. But Mel, this is not about you. I'm completely hijacking this conversation in the most disgraceful way. Let's talk about you. Let's get started with the early days, shall we? It's taken us 20 minutes to get here. But tell me about little Mel, because there's all sorts of fun nuggets about you out there, like your first word was Leatherhead and all this kind of thing. But what was childhood for you?
Childhood was sheer Leatherhead in the 70s. That's exactly what it was. And my book is set in Leatherhead.
Yes, it is.
For that very reason. I mean, Leatherhead is literally, take a slice out of me like a piece of Brighton rock and you will see the word Leatherhead. It goes deep. In fact, the book, I'm hoping, is going to be one of three. I want to write a Leatherhead trilogy because... I sort of think Leatherhead's not really been on the cultural map enough, and I've written the first one obviously, but I've got three story ideas all set in Leatherhead, so that's the sort of plan. And I think my childhood wasn't really in Leatherhead. Here am I saying, oh yeah, Leatherhead. I was in the suburbs of Leatherhead.
Okay.
I mean, imagine that. We're not even talking the suburbs of London. We're talking the suburbs of Leatherhead. And we grew up in a very lovely cul-de-sac. It was a new-build cul-de-sac. I think it had been built just after I was born. I was born in 68. I think it was born... Oh, no, it must have been born before. It must have been built in 67. Anyway, new-build cul-de-sac outside Leatherhead with the fam. So I was one of four, youngest of four kids, and mum and dad, and a very, very... Quite a lively bunch, I'm not going to lie. You know, there were three channels in those days. The TV was very small and black and white, so we had to make a lot of our own entertainment, which mainly involved my mum locking us all out of the house so she could get some peace inside the house. And she would just sort of, you know, read, actually, and smoke. and have a few hours of peace away from the horrendous kind of showings off and banterousness of her family.
So would this put you in the garden or on the streets? What are we looking at here with the four? Well,
it was very safe, so it was a lovely cul-de-sac, and obviously we knew everyone in the cul-de-sac. So it was good times, I'm not going to lie. We were in and out of each other's houses. There were a couple of fields, actually, which are no longer there. Sadly, they've been built on. But a couple of fields on the other side of the housing development. So we used to run around there a lot. There was a pond locally. We used to go down the pond. Fetcham, the village of Fetcham, was not too far, the sweet shop. It was pretty good. You know, there were a lot of bicycles, roller skates, and just mucking about. And it is, you know, my kids hate it when I go on about it, but it's that awful thing you find yourself saying, you know, we went out in the morning and we didn't come back till it was dark.
Yep.
But it really was. Yep. It was like that. You know, and we wore the same outfit every day for sort of 10 years. You know, you had your plimsolls, your shorts, your T-shirt, and that was that.
Jobs
are good,
isn't it? So youngest of four, does that explain the sort of confidence, the quick-witted nature, the ability to perform,
because you've had
to fight for time and attention, or is it? Am I reading too much into it?
No, I think what it explains is a terrible innate desire to show off. That's exactly what it is. You know, you're looking for airtime in quite a busy little house, and the only way you can get it is if you push the boat out slightly. I'm afraid that's all it is. It's sheer exhibitionism.
That's brilliant.
You know, allied closely to the 1970s and to Leatherhead, and that's a pretty toxic combination.
Was there is there part of you that has always kind of wanted to be like, well, I'm going to stand out? Because, you know, obviously the last one, the littlest for the longest period of time and so on and so forth. You know, you've got a lot of shoes to fill, as it were.
Well, always hand-me-down shoes. Oh, my, hand-me-down twice over, because it would go to my older sister and then to my middle sister and then to me.
Yes.
So twice hand-me-downed. But also there's this thing that, you know, my brother's the eldest, Miko, who's an absolute ledge, such a good egg. There are albums devoted to him, photo albums. There are about seven photo albums of his, you know, babyhood, toddlerhood, young child, teen, all the way through. And then it gets down to sort of number four. I think there's one photo of me as a baby, and it's taken from really far away. Mum was probably, you know, half cut. Poor thing. She was absolutely at the end of her tether by the time I arrived. So it's slightly out of focus. And you sort of think, well, I've got to do something to garner some attention. The sister next up from me, Koki, who's also a very good egg. She lives very close to me. In fact, I think I just heard the door go downstairs, and I know it was her dropping off some marmalade, but that's another story. She has always said, there's a little character in the Jungle Book, which ties very in nicely to your Mowgli tattooist, but and it's when they arrive at the court of King Louis, Baloo and Mowgli arrive at King Louis's court, and there's this little monkey that gets up on a plinth, and it's got this huge kind of wig of white hair.
Oh, yes.
And my sis says that's exactly who I am, in a nutshell. On the plinth in a massive white wig showing off. desperate times.
Brilliant. Well, obviously, you know, Leatherhead and number four served you very well, because it got you to Cambridge, which, you know, let's be fair, is pretty darn impressive.
I feel bad, you know. I feel like I certainly wouldn't get in nowadays, put it that way. I think in the 80s, there must have been some kind of loophole for something or other. I mean, I did really enjoy modern languages. I think that was my kind of skill. I wasn't very good at other stuff so much, but I definitely loved speaking different languages. So that's what I got in on. But I think the reason I really applied to Cambridge was because of the comedy. It had this amazing tradition for comedy, and that's how I met Sue, my comedy partner Sue, and actually that's the reason that she applied to Cambridge as well. We talk about it now and we're just like, how the hell did we both get into Cambridge? We were so lazy. We were so lazy. I feel ashamed. I think if I was there now, I'd really work my backside off, because, you know, I think you have to really these days, probably.
Yes, it's fascinating, isn't it? You know, kind of people always think, well, I would go back and do, but I'm very fortunate in my job, and you do this a lot yourself as well. You get to meet and chat to lots of high achieving, fascinating people, and they often say things about university or you know that kind of chapter before suddenly breaking it. Oh, I wish I'd done this, that, and the other. And I often think, well, why? Because look where you are. You know, you played it exactly how you should have done because of your circumstances now.
Yeah, I mean, it was a strange one because I think everyone sort of thinks. Well, not everyone, but, you know, we've had people sort of say to us, Sue and I, say, oh, so, you know, lucky old you, you know, straight from Cambridge, in the footlights, da-da-da, into the media. It really wasn't like that. It wasn't like that. I mean, I think doing the comedy at uni, and it's not just at Cambridge. I mean, there's brilliant, there are amazing comedy scenes in universities all over the country. You know, you look at the likes of Julie Walters and Victoria Wood, who came out of Manchester, you know, Steve Coogan came out of Manchester. But anyway, so we had, it was a really quite a long 7 to 8 year gap having left Cambridge before we really got our break, which was light lunch. And those years, I mean, they were full of laughter and full of real downtimes as well, you know, because I did a lot of bar work and waitressing. Sue was doing, she did door to door work. Can you imagine opening the door and having Sue Perkins there selling you some Hoover equipment? Yeah.
That would be a very peculiar experience.
I know. She wouldn't stop talking either. I often say to her, how did you actually get round any of the roads? Because she can talk for Britain, that one. So yeah, there were quite a few years really before we landed our break, which was doing this crazy daytime show on Channel 4, which very few people watched. I mean,
I watched it, and it became late lunch, didn't it?
It became late. I always preferred it as light though, because tucked away there in the middle of the day, you literally could get away with murder. I mean, literally. The stuff we did on that show and sketches and all sorts, you wouldn't get away with it now.
Yeah, that's true.
Because there was that feeling of just nobody really quite knew what you were doing. We were essentially in the nook at that time of day. You know, you were hidden away in the schedules, and it was amazing fun. And that was 2 years, and that really was our sort of training. That's how we. I say training. I say that word very, very loosely, but it's how we got the experience, I suppose, of doing it every day and having to think on our feet. It was live, having to deal with all manner of guests coming through the doors. I mean, it was terrific. It was so much fun. And, you know, now in our sort of early dotage at age 52, well, Sue's 51, which is annoying. But anyway, we do talk about it a lot. If we sit down and have a drink together, whatever, we always will end up talking about light lunch, because just it was our whole life, you know. It was so much happened. There were so many things that went wrong, so many anecdotes, some guests that behaved really badly and some guests that were brilliant, you know. So we always end up talking about light lunch. It's probably quite boring for anybody else, but we really love it.
But it was also a time for you where you didn't have, and correct me if I'm wrong, but life distractions were a lot lower.
No,
you could be so focused on the show. The show was life, right?
It absolutely was, totally. And we were in our late 20s. Neither of us engaged in any particular particularly important relationship. You know, we were still, you know, slightly ships passing through the old night of the relationships. And we didn't have mortgage. Actually, no, we did. No, because it was the first time either of us had really earned any money. So both of us did it gave us the chance. We were extremely lucky to be able to put down deposits and buy our first flat, you know. So we did have mortgages, but life was very responsibility-free, though. It was just go into work, be with the gang, have a laugh, do the show, come back from work. You know, it was an amazing time of our lives, and I will never, ever forget it, or indeed, I'll always be grateful for it, because it kind of started us off really properly. I mean, we've done years of going around doing Edinburgh Festival and playing art centre gigs and writing for other people. You know, we were kind of earning our spurs, and that was for 7 years. So it was a long time. And we got to the point, I think, where we just thought, this isn't really going anywhere at all. We've got to give this up. We're in too much debt, and, you know, this is not a goer. We've just got to face up to it. This is not a goer. So it's been wonderful, but we're not gonna pursue this. And then this blooming audition for a daytime show came up, and we were so kind of snobby. We said to our agent, "Well, we're not doing that audition." And she was like, you know, we were like, "We're cutting edge comedians." We really weren't. We were a dodgy sketch act. But anyway, in our heads, we were very rock and roll, very cutting edge. So we were like, "Yeah, no, we're not doing that." And she was like, "I'm so sorry. You know, you really are going to do this, and you will be grateful for it." She was very, very scary, our agent at the time. So we thought, well, yeah, okay, we're just going to go along and just like subvert it and have a real laugh.
Nice. Yes.
So that, I'm afraid to say, is what we did. It was a 15-minute slot. There were many other double acts auditioning as well.
So it was specifically a double act they were looking for?
They were looking for a double act, yeah. Yes. They wanted either a married couple, a sort of Richard and Judy.
Okay. That wouldn't have worked. There
was a married couple at the time who we were up against. They chose two to go up against each other in a sort of pilot off. And we were astonished that we were chosen over this married couple, because we just thought, no one knows who we are. And they took a real punt, bless them. Channel 4, back in the day, they were cutting edge.
They were, but it was...
They took risks,
but
they took risks.
It was clearly,
you know,
the right choice. You know, I mean, look what happened afterwards. It was a huge success. I mean, I remember distinctly when you guys... In fact, I have a vague memory. I think I saw the two of you at the Edinburgh Festival before you'd made it.
Oh, dear.
I have just a vague memory. I mean...
I'm sorry. I'll give you your money back, mate. Honestly, I'm really sorry. I can't believe we actually charged people money to come in and see that stuff. But all the shows were half written. We'd never finished writing a show by the time we got to Edinburgh. There was one, I'm very, very deeply ashamed to say, that we had to take out folders halfway through because we didn't know the lines.
Wow. That's
we had a lever arch folder each. And I seem to remember we were very open about it. Well, obviously we had to be because it was so obvious. And we said, we stopped the show and said, "I'm really sorry, gang. We haven't quite finished learning this. So we're just going to do this from the folder." I mean, the chutzpah, the absolute, I mean, you wouldn't do that now, would you?
No, you wouldn't. But it's in the wheelhouse of experiences that you've had, and that makes it fascinating. Crazy. So you burst on the scene, obviously, like you said. And what I love about this is that there's that old phrase, isn't there? My 10-year overnight success. Because people only see you when you've made it. So they just assume you've suddenly made it. No one realises the effort and the graft and all of that.
It's really annoying. Listen, it's lovely that people are vaguely interested. So you have to sort of, you know, it's absolutely lovely. But it is quite funny. They do just think that you've come out sort of microwave ready from university and bing into a TV show every day of the week. no, it really doesn't. It doesn't work. It doesn't work like that. It really doesn't.
When the two of you became household, you know, when you were on telly every day, national telly and so on, and when everyone started to know who Mel and Sue were. I mean, I remember you guys were dubbed as the female Ant and Dec, etc. And I'm asking this because I can't remember. So apologies for this.
But no. It was 30 years ago.
Well, yeah, but I'll be delicate because it's something that I think is quite curious and pertinent for the, you know, the time, etc. Did people think you were a couple when you were first on screen together?
Always, absolutely, always. I mean, right. even now, I take it as a real compliment. Actually, I really love the way that people think we're a couple. Even now, people will sort of say, "So, you know." You've been together a long time. I take it as an absolute compliment. I mean, we always howl with laughter about it because I don't know. I mean, I love Sue with every atom of my being, and I hope, you know, vice versa. She is literally, you know, my bestest friend.
Yeah.
And she's like family. But there has never, ever, ever been an occasion where we've ever thought, so, yeah. Shall we seal the deal? Shall we seal the deal here?
Yeah, and it all went wrong. Here's the moment when it didn't quite work out. Well,
No, I mean, we have shared many a bed together. Oh, yeah, we've bunked up together as good pals do. But I can honestly say, hand on heart, I think this goes for both of us. We've never wanted to go there. She's seen me nude many times. And I've seen her nude. She's very private, young Susan. I think in my older age, I'm a bit more like, yeah, come on, get it all out. Yep, this is it. Have a look at it. There you go. No, I have seen Perks in the nude. She probably won't remember, but I have. I've put her to bed several times.
Which tells its own story. That's brilliant. Although I would ask you why you're fully undressing her to go to bed if she's had a few too many. I mean, you could leave the clothes on now.
No, to be honest, I think she's probably done that to me more than I've done that to her. God bless her. No, she's an absolute cracker. We often say, and now we are approaching, well, we're 50, I suppose, but we've often said, you know, we'll end up in an old people's home together. Yes, that's the reality. That literally is the reality. And I, with my husband, obviously, and with Sue's partner, and I really pity the other people in the old folks' home because it'll be like lunch anecdotes, mate, from dawn till dusk.
I was going to say that would be perfect. I mean, you would be the living television. You know that sort of
awful.
That slightly naive impression of an old folks' home where they're all sitting in their comfy chairs and so on, and the telly's on, and there's no remote control, so they have to have whatever's on the screen. And it would have been. I mean, do you know? I was taught this in the very first job I ever did, Mel, on telly. Was I used to host Children's ITV, right? So I would be the guy that pops up in between the shows.
Yes,
I know.
You were brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
Well, I was told on my first day, my producer, who was also the puppeteer, incidentally, which made it quite entertaining.
Oh, wow.
He said to me, you have to imagine, Andy, you're not just trying to entertain the kids of the nation, but those people in the old folks' home that have had the remote control taken off them, and they're forced to watch you. So you have to give your best every single show. And I've never forgotten that. I've never forgotten that.
I love that. I absolutely love that. And I'm with you there. I think if you do something, if you have the privilege to be able to sort of perform for a living, you've got to give it 110%.
Yeah.
What's the blooming point? What is the blooming point otherwise? Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
That's amazing. That's very good advice. That's a terrible thought, though. In the old folks' home, and Sue and I are there, and you can't turn us off. That's terrible.
That would be brilliant.
No, mate. No, that's like a sort of, you know, that's a blooming, what's his face, who wrote, see the mind's going, that wrote the awful play where hell is other people. It's Wicklow. It's Wicklow. It's Sartre. Sartre.
Well,
you'll be in an existential Sartrean nightmare.
What I love about this, though, Mel, is that it wouldn't just be in the main sort of rec room area of the old folks' home. You'd then obviously go into the canteen. You'd be assessing the quality of the food. You know, talking to the chef about what they're making and putting,
yes.
Watching it. And it would be fascinating.
It literally sounds like a living hell for other people. For Sue and I, obviously tremendous. I mean, we'll keep going for as long as you want. Yeah. Press the button. We will literally keep on going. That's quite a thought. You know, there's an amazing old people's home in West London. I'm sure there are many around the country. That the one that I know of is in West London, but and it's for old actors. It's for old actors and performers. Yeah, it's really cool. I've done some bits and bobs for them actually. Yeah, really cool. I'm slightly hoping I can put my name down quite soon.
I was going to say, you're basically laying the foundations, aren't you, Mel? You're kind of like,
mate, imagine if you looked around. Imagine if you looked around the telly room, and there was Rachel Weisz, Daniel Craig, Tom Hiddleston. You know, it'd be so good.
Maxine
Peake's in there. It would be very, very cool. It would be so cool. I think you probably have to be a member of Equity first up.
Right.
And you probably, I think it may be more of a sort of, you know, high class theatre acting establishment, in which case.
Yeah, you've done plenty at the West End. I would suggest that you've got the posters to prove it.
I've dabbled, darling. You know, one dabbles.
Well, Much Ado About Nothing is not dabbling. Stephen Sondheim's company, that's not dabbling. These are lofty, challenging, hardcore pieces of theatre.
Oh, well, no, they were good. They were good fun. I have to say, Company, which is a musical written by Stephen Sondheim, was feasibly, I mean, yeah, it's top three, one of the top three things I've ever been involved with, because it was Patti LuPone, for Pete's sake. I mean, she is the living legend diva of Broadway, and there aren't many of her ilk around. I'd say she's one of two or three, you know, the real proper, old school. You know, she originated the role of Fantine in Les Mis back in the day. She was the first Evita on Broadway. You know, she's hot stuff, Patti LuPone. And it was amazing to be on a stage with her 6 months every night, eight shows a week, and just watch her and see the audience.
Yeah.
It was unbelievable. It was unbelievable. That voice, you know, she's in her early 70s now, still very much going strong. She's doing loads of stuff on screen in America, which is brilliant. And seeing that pair of lungs pumping away every night, it was quite something, actually. It really was. And it makes you think, it's like Mary Berry, you know, you kind of think, these are seasoned, wonderful women who go out and they give 110%. I love that. They're icons. I love them.
Well, you have to, don't you? You said it yourself a few moments ago. When you're in a position like that, whatever the performance, whoever the audience, and
hell
whatever
you're
doing, you've got to give it everything, because it's such an honour to be at that kind of table, isn't it?
Totally. Mate, I appeared, I'm not even exaggerating. This was a slight wilderness time, post-light lunch. I was doing a little gig for Comic Relief. It was wilderness years. I was in Terminal 5. Actually, was Terminal 5 built? No, maybe it was Terminal 4. I was in Terminal 4 of Heathrow Airport with Limahl from Katagugu singing Too Shy Shy to British Airways workers at 6:30 in the morning, mate.
Well, goodness
and
me.
Did I give it 100%? Did I give it 110%? Yes, I did, Andy. Yeah. I gave it the full run. There was nobody there. There were only BA staff who were just thinking, yes, Limahl, we know who you are. You don't know who you are. We gave it absolutely ruddy everything.
Wow.
And I think that's what you've got to do. You have to.
Yes, you do.
You have to.
Yes, you do. I mean, you mentioned the barren years, as it were. You did. And people don't realise this, I think, Mel, because of course, you know, I think there's such a sort of public love for you and such an awareness of everything you're doing that I think people forget the schlog moment that you had. That's probably not even a word, but I think you know what
I mean. I like it. I very much like
Let's call it schlug. I don't know. It's schlug something anyway, you know.
Schlug.
But you did. You had a moment, you know, obviously late lunch, etc. It did come to an end.
Absolutely.
The pre-bake-off years.
Yeah.
I mean, you were close to bankruptcy, weren't you?
I certainly was, my friend. I certainly was. Now, listen, you must stop me talking, because I can talk about this for about 5 hours. So, you know, let's hold this back for the old folks home. Let's keep that in storage for when the old folks home comes along. In a nutshell, basically, yeah, light lunch finished, late lunch finished. I met my absolute ledge of a husband, Ben, and I got married and I had children, and I sort of didn't want to be a totally full-time working mum. I obviously wanted to give the girls, you know, the best I could in terms of my time and my parenting skills, which, have been up and down. But work sort of took second place. I say that, I wasn't offered much either. I think there is a thing in comedy, maybe, certainly I've heard other actors, actresses talk about this, that if you have kids, people sort of think you've died, you know. Right. They kind of think, oh, right, okay, she's having kids, right, we won't call her up. Mm. And I don't know if it's the same these days, I hope it's not. But I think certainly back in the day, there was a little bit of that. And also I took myself out of the game because I wanted to be at home more. So I did bits and bobs. Sue and I did the odd thing together. I did a bit of theatre, which was fun, but I certainly wasn't really earning very much money. And things got a little bit ropey on the old financial front. And I was doing an advert at the time. Sue and I were doing it together for a bread brand.
Oh, yes. Yes, yes, yes. The better bread one, yes.
The better bread. No, which is weird because it's before Bake Off, you know, before Bake Off had even happened. Anyway, we were doing this bread ad and it was good. It was keeping us going as a family. And I was thinking, well, brilliant. All I need to do is the bread ad. Don't need to do anything else, really. I'm at home with the kids. This is amazing. I am so, so lucky. Anyway, pushed the boat out, bought a house, probably way, 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 way more than we could afford. But the bank was saying, yes, borrow loads of money. Massive mortgage, blah, blah, blah. You know the story.
Oh, yeah.
The bread ad's still there. I thought, this is fine. Anyway, got a letter through the Ruddy Post from the bread ad people saying, thank you very much. That was the last one.
Huh.
And I was thinking, yeah. Right, that's my livelihood, which is ludicrous. Who bases their livelihood on one ad a year or two ads a year? I mean, I should have asked some advice. Anyway, long story short, we lost our house, which wasn't particularly pleasant, but it was a good experience to go through because it meant that we had to cut our cloth, and we rented for 2 years, and we were never happier. We had no mortgage, put all our stuff into storage, and it was good. It was a salutary lesson, and it's meant that since then, hopefully, I live within my means, and I think that's an important thing to do. And also, sorry, I'm really on a roll now. I do apologise.
No, I'm loving
You've probably gone off to make a cup of tea, and I salute you for that.
Got to have some toast, actually. All this reference to bread and.
No, but it was the kernel of the story, which has become my novel, which is about a family. It's not about my family. It's nothing to do with my family, but it's about a very, very, very well-off family.
Yes.
Living the life in Leatherhead. And they lose everything, absolutely everything. And I definitely felt at the time that this was kind of happening to us, although it didn't happen in nearly as dramatic a way as I write it in the book. But I did think, I'm going to write about this one day because it made, you know, it made a big impression on our lives, and it changed the way that we lived and everything. So interesting.
It's exactly, I mean, and that's the reason why I asked it, obviously. By the way, and I've got so many questions about the book. Just a very quick one on Bake Off. Do you think doing the bread ad, because you mentioned it was before Bake Off, of course, do you think that was like a subliminal thing that led to, I've never even thought of that before.
No, I don't know. I mean, the whole Bake Off thing is so mad. That just came out of the clear blue sky, out of nowhere, just bizarre. And I mean, I've said this, you know, publicly before, but we did the first series and I just thought, this is appalling. This is you know, Sue and I on the phone the whole time, just saying, mate, what have we done?
Wow.
This will go nowhere. Luckily, no one will see it. But what we have just done was possibly the worst thing we've ever done in our career.
Goodness.
And there are a few things competing for that, believe you me. And then, cut two, out of the blue, it didn't happen straight away, but after a couple of series, I mean, who knew? That was bizarre.
Well.
I mean, I love life for that reason, that it can just throw you what seems to be an absolute honking great big turkey, and then the turkey flies.
Yeah.
You know,
it really
bizarre.
Did, though. I mean, it absolutely captured the imagination like few other shows, actually. You know, when you read the synopsis of the show, the idea of it, it's a no on paper. Of course it doesn't.
Isn't it?
Watching people bake, no. How is that interesting on any level? And yet it's
I
lovely.
Know.
It's a little joyous slice of loveliness. And of
it's
course,
bizarre.
You know, Paul Hollywood's delightful blue eyes.
Listen, those eyes, they are... Have you seen the eyes in real life? Have you come up against them?
Yeah, several times.
It is extraordinary, isn't it?
Yes.
It's like Terence Stamp has those eyes.
He does,
Steve McQueen had those eyes. And I think actually Mary Berry has them as well. There's something utterly just... they're made for the screen, aren't they? It's bizarre.
They are. Yes, he's raced in some championships that I've hosted before. And you know, you don't get the impact in a helmet. Then he takes the helmet off and you're like, oh my goodness, whoa. Hello, Hypno Eyes.
Those championships, oh my days. We're in the green room in Bake Off, the four of us, Paul, Mary, Sue and I. We were subjected to so much ruddy Formula One on the telly. We had one telly and we wrestled over the controls, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
Sue and I were really into Mad Men at the time.
Oh.
So that's all that we wanted to watch.
Channeling Don Draper, love it.
Channeling Draper. Hollywood, all he would conceive of watching was something with a stupid car in it. So we were all subjected to that. And then Beza, as far as I remember, she got really into Jeremy Kyle. She wanted to watch Kyle a lot.
Oh, yes.
Those were the days, the noughties. The noughties into the tensies.
I like to hope that there was a little bit of Judge Judy thrown in there as well.
Sorry about the dinging. I don't think we did any JJ actually at the time.
What a shame.
It was MM, Mad Men. It was blooming Top Gear, Formula One.
And Kyle.
And Kyle.
DNA tests. Brilliant.
Yeah. Oh, actually, Sue brought in some quite good... sort of Angelina Jolie action movies. We watch Salt and things like that.
Oh, that's fair play. And appropriate,
really
actually.
Good.
Salt,
yeah.
And, you know, baking. Yeah, makes sense. That's...
Exactly. Clever. So, they were very... I mean, what a blooming joy to have those 7 years and to sort of get earning again and, you know, I don't know, just to be in a show that people... really seemed to find comforting and that they really related to. It was a very, very special thing, actually. I feel very, very lucky that we got the chance to do that.
Yes.
I really do. You know, we've got nothing but good memories of that show. I mean, I think, you know, leaving it was difficult and a bit strange and the circumstances were a bit odd, but I sort of feel we kind of left it at the right time, actually, with a bit of hindsight. We left it at the right time. We left it while the party was still going. And it's important to leave the party when it's still going, I think.
The old phrase, it's better to quit while you're ahead.
Absolutely. Before the sandwiches start to curl up, you know.
before Hollywood gets cataracts.
Oh, God. No, I can't bear the thought of that.
Conjunctivitis. Yeah. Oh, I can't look. I can't look at those Hypno Eyes now. They're all cloudy and yuck.
Oh gosh. Oh.
Now look, we have to talk about the best. The best things is this remarkable story. You've touched on your own, you know, financial challenges, etc. Whenever I read a book that's just out, I'm always scared to give too much of the plot away because I hate being the guy that spoils it. But you wrote it, so you're allowed to share as much as you want. Do you want it? Because I've got questions, but I'll make sure the questions aren't spoiler-ish questions, if that makes sense.
Listen, you go right ahead. You go right ahead. I'll try not, because it is just out, so I'll try not to spoil it too much. But, yeah, go on.
Okay, so without saying too much, you've alluded to the fact that it's a family who were riding high. They had a phenomenal life, or a seemingly phenomenal life, at least materialistically. And then it all ends suddenly. And you had classic alpha male, breadwinning alpha male hero figure, father, boss, legend.
Oh dear, Frank.
Frank, bless him. You got beautiful wife.
Trophy wife,
Who is literally that. She's not a good mum, she's not a good provider, she's not a good really anything.
And
is a little bit dependent on, you know, prescription medicines and fills her days in ways that at least keep her trim, but that's about it. You know, that's her life. And then you've got a miscellany of different skill sets for children. If that makes sense. You've got the large lad who likes playing his games, and then you've got three very different young ladies, one of whom's an absolute outlier, and then the other two, you know, they're one of them's very resilient, very much in her father's mould, the other's just kind of down with the kids, very cool and hip, but not necessarily worldly smart. Is that a fair...
No, very well described, very well described, yes. And I'm sorry, I'm here kind of, I probably sound a bit smug. I'm going, I love these characters. Love them as if they're my own family. You hear writers say this a lot, don't you, that write fiction, but that you get so obsessed with your characters, and each and every one of them I totally adore. I mean, they bug the heck out of me. They're very flawed, a lot of them, but I hope that readers of the novel will sort of take them to their hearts a bit. I mean, I think Sally is my heroine, and, you know, heroines are funny, aren't they? I've been thinking a lot about heroines and what makes a heroine, and Scarlett O'Hara is often sort of touted as the sort of the ultimate heroine. I absolutely loathe Scarlett O'Hara. I loathe her. I loathe her for her spoiltness, her pamperedness. You know, the fact that she has this kind of rich, sort of awful Southern Belle life. But then I love her. I love her to her core when everything gets stripped away from her.
Right.
And she has to literally dig the soil, you know, to survive when war breaks out, you know. And I sort of feel Sally Parker for me is, I mean, I would never say that I've written a Scarlett O'Hara. I would never have the smugness to say that. But Sally Parker is definitely somebody who starts the novel as somebody, she's put her life on pause. You know, she's pressed the snooze button on herself. She's a strange cipher of a woman. And then this thing happens to them. They lose everything. And then that's when she comes into her own. And, you know, I thought quite a lot about Thelma and Louise, who I love as heroines. I thought about Scarlett O'Hara a lot. It's women that are put right through the ringer and have to prove themselves. And I hope that you come away having read the book and you think, yes, Sally Parker, I like you. I like you now. You've shown your true colours.
Oh, yeah.
And
I mean, this, do you know, one of the things I would say, Mel, sorry to interrupt you, but I feel like I feel the need to tell you because I've read it rather than, you know.
Bless you.
And that is that actually, Sally, yes, of course, there's this huge journey that you go on with Sally. But actually, one of the things that comes across to me in the book, and it's a long book, by the way, it's not one of these kind of, you know, took you a couple of weeks to knock out. This is a very well-crafted, brilliantly told story. But the thing that really strikes me is that all the characters, the ones we've talked about, and then their ancillary friends, the business partners, the headmistresses, the best friends, the so-called people around the scene that are in and around the family, they're all so well drawn. You don't, there's nothing one-dimensional or even two-dimensional. You get so much detail. You live in each character's skin, and you do jump between characters at times, which is great, you know. You'll have a quick moment in the school here, or a moment in the office with a different character, or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
And in each case, you completely occupy that character's thinking and what their process is and why they're doing what they're doing. And there's not many stories that you can say that about.
Well, that's incredibly kind of you to say so. I know, I mean, I've said it before, but it was all about the characters for me. It was just, I got totally, totally obsessed with them. And it's weird actually, in the process of writing it, suddenly a character would sort of appear and I think, oh, hello.
Yeah.
Hello. Hello, sailor. Who are you? I like the look of you. I want to expand on you. There are a few of the characters sort of on the edges of the story who definitely I became very addicted to, and I sort of felt, look, I've got to flesh you out because I'm just really enjoying it. I think.
Well, and the brothers and the mothers as well. They're wonderful. At a whole new level. Oh, it's great.
Thank you.
I mean, honestly, Mel, I can say this because we've had such a lovely chat. I feel I can be honest with you. This isn't the sort of book that I traditionally would go to, you know, as a sort of action-seeking, you know, graphic novel-loving bloke. You know, I wouldn't sort of naturally go to, oh, okay. I was absolutely enchanted. I really, really enjoyed it. It's a great read.
Thank you very, very much. I'm very pleased to hear a man say that, actually, because, you know, I suppose that the heroine of the book is Sally Parker. You know, she is the kind of the centerpiece, and everything focuses on her and plays out around her. But I really hope that I've managed to write the male characters with good depth as well, because because I love the male characters in the book. I'm very, very wedded to Dr. Livesey, who's the slightly nerdy private doctor, and Frank Parker, who's the main chap, and his business partner Amajit. You know, I love all of them, but that's good to hear you say that, because you know, I think obviously some men write women brilliantly. Not all men write women brilliantly, and some women write men well, and some just don't. So, I mean, I hope I've attempted to write the male characters as best as I could.
You've absolutely nailed it, Mel. I mean, genuinely, you know, I wouldn't have done it in one hit if I hadn't been desperate to know how it was going on and if I didn't care about these people. And I really, really do.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so. That means the world. It really does. Because you sit there, you know, I wrote it in my local library. This was obviously before the pandemic, and back in the days when the library was open, and because I thought that's the only way I'm going to write this book is if I leave the house. There's no way on God's earth I'm going to sit down and write a draft of this novel if I'm in the house. So I went to the local library every single day, and I can't remember where I was going with this. Where was I going on this ramble? I don't know. Anyway.
Being able to write the men. No, I mean, and you mentioned early doors as well, that this is going to be one of a trilogy. And I love this, but you called it the Leatherhead Trilogy. You see, I want to know where some of these other characters are going. Are you going to, will these characters be returning, or are we...
I'm glad you said that. I'm just going to give you, because I've started to plot the second book already. And my feeling is it's not going to be about the Parkers. Okay. I think we're going to park them. Excuse me. We're going to park them for a while. They may come back at some other point, but some of the peripheries you may be seeing again.
Oh, goody.
There may be a couple of the periffs that come in to number two. That's all I'm going to say.
That is wonderful, because the periffs are juicy, and several of them you think, well, you've got to, surely. Surely you can explore, because some of them are quite vile people that would be fascinating characters as well, which is good.
I really enjoyed writing the toxic ones, actually. I felt I got a few things off my chest, you know. I mean, it was quite fun. There's one character, I'm not going to say who he is, it is one of the male characters, who is quite closely based on a friend of a friend, which does worry me a bit.
Ooh, interesting. Interesting.
Yeah. Well, I worry if there's going to be a little bit of payback there. That's all I'm going to say.
Well, here's a question for you, Mel, and I'm mindful of the time as well, by the way. So I'm acutely aware that I'm stealing your time now. But I've got to ask.
Lovely, I love it.
I'm loving it. I'm very, very curious. There's a scene, and this only works as a question to those who've read the book, but those who are going to read it might want to now wonder why I'm going there. Because of course, a lot of this is drawn from. I know it's fictional, but you know. We all always write best about what we've learnt and lived.
Absolutely.
There is a scene in a wood with our heroine and a landlord. Has such a thing happened to you?
No, oh. Andy. Absolutely. Oh, how very dare you? No. And in fact, that scene I found quite difficult to write because it should be, you know, there should be something a little bit touching about that scene. It's also a bit sinister, but I won't go into that.
A creepy scene. I mean, it was.
Yeah, it is a bit creepy. It is a bit creepy. Yeah. He's creepy, isn't he?
He's creepy. And her reaction is creepy. You wonder how she's going to respond, and you're like, she's not going to. She's going to what? And then, hang on. Okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
You know, this. Yeah. That. Yeah.
You see, I hadn't meant that to happen. That was a thing that happened. I hadn't plotted that at all, genuinely.
Brilliant.
And that was a thing that happened on the hoof. And I suddenly thought, let's massively put her through the ringer here.
Yeah.
So that is why that woodland scene happened. Well, it just happened because I wrote it and I wasn't planning to. It's weird. It's sort of, I'm going to be really pretentious now. Okay. I'm sorry. And this is because I did modern languages as a degree. And I'm really sorry about this. There's a brilliant Pirandello play. You probably read it. Six characters in search of an author.
Oh, I know it off by heart. Yeah.
So. Yeah, it's about the idea of this author who is visited by these characters and they sort of take him over. It was written in the '20s, you know, it was really sort of, you know, ahead of its time and amazing. I love it. It's a brilliant play. And this is what happened in the woodland scene. The character who was only a blooming bit part took me over. And that's what happened. Yeah. Yeah, there you go.
And what a moment of impact as well, because it informs a whole load of new choices and decisions. And yeah.
Yep.
Great.
Yep.
Oh, how exciting.
I'm so glad you've read it. That really tickles me and makes me feel very warm inside. I'm not going to lie.
Oh, well,
there's something.
It was a pleasure to read, Mel. I mean, it genuinely was a pleasure. And I'll be completely transparent with you as well. Sometimes when you, I mean, you know this, doing an interview when you have subjects and so on and so forth, you don't have time generally to read everything and watch everything.
No.
And, you know, quite often I'll get sent a series and people expect me to have watched every single episode. And you're like, oh, you know.
I know. You've got to dabble. You've got to dip. You've got to dip and dabble. I mean, like your good self. I've dipped and dabbled, I'm not going to lie to you, many a time. So, no, completely.
It happens.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, you use the internet for resources and things and this, that and the other. But
yeah.
And so I was thinking to myself as I sat down to approach this, I was like, okay, you know, it's probably not my kind of book, but I love Mel. I've always had this great affection for you. So, you know, I'll give it an hour. It was in my head. I was like, I'll give it an hour and it'll at least, you know, give me a good idea. And I couldn't stop. I genuinely couldn't stop. Absolutely.
Thank you. That's extremely lovely of you. And you've made a perimenopausal woman from Leatherhead extremely happy. Seriously. You're my friend for life now. That's it. We are wedded together in friendship.
Well, I mean, that's wonderful for me to hear. I'm absolutely overjoyed. You'll be very cross soon because I'll start to take liberties. You know, I'll be showing up asking about that marmalade, etc. You know, I'll be wanting to know what's going on. And thoroughly getting involved. We'll also have to talk about Florence's smoking a bit more because, you know, we've got to deal with that now. You know, now that I'm in the friendship group, you know.
I know, and your tattoo, how's that going to work out? What's going to happen?
I know.
You know, I'll need to be kept very up to speed with all that, with Mowgli's work.
Well,
actually, that's a good character, actually, for a novel. That's a very good character.
He's a fascinating individual as well. I mean, he's I've never met him. I've only obviously had email exchanges, but I know what he looks like, and he's got a vibe. You'd like him. You could definitely write about him.
Yeah, that's a very good. I like the idea of a tattooist character. Oh yeah, there's legs. There are legs there, Andy. There are legs.
There are, aren't there? Especially if he was catering specifically to a sort of bored housewife market.
Yeah, yes. God, can you imagine?
Wow.
Amazing. Amazing.
Love it.
I like it.
A lounge lizard with a needle.
You've got me going now. I've got to get to my notebook and write this goal down.
Oh, I can't wait. I am so excited. I'm so excited. Mel, you've been such a special, wonderful guest and so open as well. I really appreciate your candor. You know, just so nice of you to give me so much of your time and company, and you've been a sensational conversation guest and buddy.
Listen, it's very, very lovely to talk to you. And, you know, in these strange times, it's just lovely to chat, isn't it?
Yes.
To have some good old human interaction is always good.
Amazing. What a joy. I wish you only love and success with everything. It's been such a pleasure, Mel. And thank you very much.
Thank you. Speak soon. Okay.
Look forward to it. Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye. The Andy J
Podcast. I told you I was a bit gushy, didn't I? My thanks, my huge thanks to Mel Gedridge. I just thought she was brilliant. And of course, even bigger thanks to you, the listener, for hanging out here and being part of our fun little club. I really do appreciate it. It genuinely means the world to me, the number of you that are checking us out and listening to our shows and our chats week in, week out. I really can't thank you enough. Got a very cool show for you next week. By the way, Mel has been absolutely delightful to me since our chat, which, as I said at the start, was a few weeks ago. She's just really good company. Haven't quite got to the point now where I'm kind of showing up with a takeout and I can sit and watch telly with her on a sofa yet, but I'll get there, maybe, at some point. We shall see. Next week, goodness me, couple of really big conversations for you. We have a musical guru, Alan McGee, founder of Creation Records, the man who discovered Oasis, Primal Scream, The Libertines, My Bloody Valentine, The Jesus and Mary Chain, and many more. Cool. He's got some stories to share. Looking forward to talking to him. And Sally Phillips, comedian, actor, writer extraordinaire. You know, she was in the Bridget Jones Diaries, she was in Miranda, she was in Alan Partridge, she was in Green Wing, she was in Smack the Pony. I mean, she is a decorated, brilliant, very, very funny woman. Can't wait to be chatting to her too. So that's what's on the menu for you on the Conversation Carousel on the AJ Pod next week. Hope you look forward to it. I can't wait to bring it to you. Have a fantastic week. Be kind. Give out goodness. Make someone smile. And we'll catch you on the flip side. Bye-bye.
If you're enjoying the Andy J Podcast, we'd love a review. In fact, if you're enjoying the show, why not tell your friends? Podcasts live and die on, well, often word of mouth. So please tell your friends. Like, subscribe, review, and share. Thank you.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.